Hi there and welcome along to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph.
And I'm Dave Daly.
Coming up on the programme today, in a moment, myself and Dave will discuss some of the current business headlines from the local and national papers. Then, in the business of this week, it's the business of ophthalmology, or glasses and all of that sort of stuff. Dave went along to the newest branch of Specsavers in Donaghmede Shopping Centre that opened just before Christmas, where he spoke with Jason Reynolds.
In a new feature on Nearby Business, we call Taking Care of Business, Connor Phillips will be here to tell us how to prepare for a crisis.
David Bell from the year after that for his regular look at HR issues. This week, David will look at how to conduct an exit interview when an employee is about to leave your business.
And finally, Alan McQuaid, who is the chief economist with Merrion Private, is here to chat about the hot topic of the week. Dare I say it, Brexit.
Now, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories that we have this evening, well, you can contact us while the show is on air. You can text the number 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can get in touch anytime on Twitter. We're at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
So, Dave, some interesting stories in the local and national papers. Lots of cranes about Dublin, but this is not a report from Birdwatch Ireland.
No, there were 104 cranes. These are ones on building sites visible over the centre of Dublin on the 1st of December. This is the highest score yet registered by the crane count, two up on the month before, a previous high of 102, and nine more than the record 93 on the 1st of September. December's count is more than triple the 31 cranes recorded on February 1st, 2016, and this is according to the Irish Times. There was a decline of six cranes to 39 counted on the north side of the Liffey as preparation work on some very large developments, particularly on the North Docklands, is gathering pace, and that's the Dublin Landings project. I know it there, just up from the Three Arena. The south side count, meanwhile, rose 8 to 65 with the construction surge clearly spreading out to the suburbs. Interestingly, however, the site clearance work has just started, and an infill on Mark Street off Pierce Street, close to the recently cleared Ned's Pub site, bounded by Moss Street and Townsend Street in the South Docklands. And nearby, another small infill site is backing onto the Dart Line, went on sale in April at more than $3 million for 0.229 acres at the corner of Townsend Street and Shaw Street. So it's all happening in the centre.
In the centre of Dublin City. Plenty of cranes, as I said, and not a sign of Birdwatch Ireland. Misleading sales tactics from Expedia, Trivago and four other online hotel booking sites. Tell, what are they at, Dave?
Yeah, Expedia and Trivago are among six online hotel booking sites that have agreed to a raft of changes to end misleading sales tactics and hidden charges after a probe by the competition watchdog. Booking.com, Agoda, Hotels.com and eBookers were also investigated by the UK Competition and Markets Authority in the UK after it raised serious concerns over tactics used in this sector. Now, the CMA said the sites have voluntarily committed to measures, including changes to make search results clearer, to end pressure selling and make discount claims more transparent and display compulsory charges. They said they will do whatever it can to bring the rest of the online hotel booking sector up to the same standard, and CMA has taken enforcement action to bring an end to misleading sale tactics, hidden charges and practices of the online hotel booking market. And these probably are things like there have been four of these sold in the last minute, last one at this price,
only one left,
that kind of thing. So that's happening in the UK, so that will probably take effect here as well, I suppose, because they will probably voluntarily self-regulate this kind of thing. But you do notice that I better book it tonight because
There won't be one tomorrow.
Double room left on the, and that sort of thing. So
it's interesting. You do see in a lot of hotel sites now as well. They if you go to the actual website of the hotel, they tell you this is cheaper than any of the online booking operators, which is interesting as well.
Yeah, and I remember one time I was booking one, and they said if you can give me, we said it's only whatever on the one of the hotel ones or whatever, and they said give us a screenshot of that and we'll give you the 10%. So they obviously are getting 10% off the things. So
off the hotel.
Interesting.
Okay, a Danish car sharing company Green Mobility is to set up a scheme in Dublin this year with a fleet of 400 electric cars.
Yeah, it's going to compete with Go Car, which is owned by Europcar, and Yuko, a car sharing club owned by Toyota Ireland. The Danish company says that, unlike its rivals, you just don't have to return cars to a designated parking location. It also offers only fully electric vehicles in its fleet. According to Anders Wall, the company's chief international officer, within the operational zone, say within the city limits, the cars can be parked anywhere that is legal. You don't have to return to a station or a designated location like you do with GoCar. Her service is literally door to door, not just A to B. Our users pay for the time they spend in the car, so when you park your car legally on the street or in certain car parks, we take care of the parking charges. We also don't charge any fixed fees, membership or sign-up fees. You only pay for the number of minutes you use. The car is opened and locked through our app, and it's available for smartphones, Apple and Android. And there are no keys in the car, so you simply drive where you need to go. Once you end the trip, you lock it again with the app, and the car becomes visible to all other users. When the charge in the car drops below 10%, the cars are automatically disappear from the app, so not available for effectively for hire. Okay. And they have a team of on-street agents who take care of charging, cleaning and maintenance of the electric car. That's great. I think that sounds absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a really good way of getting about, and you don't this whole thing of sharing ownership of a car, where you don't actually need to own the car anymore, you just really need the use of it, which is becoming, you know, with younger people, is becoming a way of life.
Yeah, brilliant.
Really interesting. Brilliant stuff.
The Business Of on Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM.
Dave, do you use glasses?
Well, it was either get glasses or get longer arms.
Well, you know what? You should have gone to Specsavers.
Well, I did.
Good morning, Specsavers. Donald me, Jason speaking. Yes, sir. Yes, 1 second now.
I'm here with Jason Reynolds of Specsavers at their new branch at Donald Shopping Centre. So firstly, Jason, tell us about Specsavers, the international brand with many local branches.
Yeah. Hi there, thank you very much indeed. We are Specsavers Donal Mead, and we opened on the 22nd of October in 2018. So 3 months anniversary on this month. Yes, we're part of the wider Specsavers group with branches throughout New Zealand, Australia, the UK obviously, and here in the Republic of Ireland, also Norway, Spain, and Holland. So a huge big family, obviously founded back in 1984 by Dame Mary Perkins and Doug Perkins, and really the business has grown from strength to strength in the last 30 years.
Is the trading model based on a franchise? They're local ownerships, that but on a broad sort of framework?
Absolutely. It's a partnership, as we call it. So yeah, very, very similar to a franchise. Probably easier, best way to explain it, is like a franchise, but it is more of a partnership.
Okay.
So myself and Rory O'Neill, he's the practicing optometrist here in store. Rory looks after the clinical side of the business. I look after the business side, run the team, the customer service. So it's a very, very much a joint venture set up. So and again, we've had to go through a lot of, I suppose, training to get here. It's not easy. It's tough work, but very, very enjoyable to get here. The business is constantly looking for new partners to come on board within the business, whether from a retail perspective like myself.
Yeah, so you're not, you were not the business.
Absolutely not. Yeah. No, I started my career back in 1989 working for Nichols Haberdasheries, I suppose,
okay,
back
good
then.
Stuff, good training.
And worked my way up through various different retail business to regional manager roles, and then joined the partnership in 2015 as a partner in development. Mm-hmm. So spent a lot of time working in stores and supporting stores here in the Republic of Ireland and the UK, and an opportunity. I've been looking at Donal Mead for nigh on 3 years, 3.5 years, so through the recession trying to get somewhere opened, but I've worked in for O2 Telefonica as one of my previous roles. I had a store here, so I know the customer base, the area, great clientele. So even we're finding ourselves, we're getting a really good touch point into people in Howth, down as far as Clontarf, up to Malahide. You know.
Yeah, I think you're well positioned here. Donal Mead has gone around for donkey's years. Mm. It's stood the test of time. The place is very nice here this morning. I haven't been in Donal Mead probably for about a year myself. Mm. It's very nice. They've lovely coffee shops upstairs. There's a nice feeling about the place, and there's a real local feel too. Mm. And you know, this is what you need. For you need a customer base that will sort of be loyal to you, come back to get them repaired and get them renewed and so on.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I live in Port Marnock myself, so 8 minutes from the store. So I don't think I get a day off, really.
Convenience, no. Who does when they work for themselves, yes.
So, but again, we've employed, we've got 12 people working here in the store.
Very good.
And 70% of the guys who work here are from the direct local area.
Just on a broader scale, how many branches of Specsavers got in Ireland? Like, obviously...
50
branches, stores, so 50, yes. 50 stores. So it's pretty wide brand. Mm-hmm. Your franchise or your partnership covers this particular area. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody wanted to open, you know, across the road, is that your territory? Just as a matter of interest, you know.
Yeah, it can be. When the guys who, I suppose, back in 95, maybe the original partners who started up in the Republic of Ireland, they would have had a broader exclusive net compared to ourselves. So we're down to 1 kilometre to 2 kilometres. That's our caption area. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense for us to open up a store a mile down the road? Not necessarily.
No, obviously sense prevails there. Just on the services you offer here, glasses, lovely branding, mm-hmm. beautiful green, you know, you've got the best brand, you've got the best catchphrase mm-hmm. in the business.
Should have gone Specsavers.
And we did, that's why we're here this morning. But, you know, it's easy here to do mm-hmm. business. It's very pleasant. Mm-hmm. The staff are pleasant when you come in. What do you offer to somebody coming in who is probably in their 50s, mm-hmm. their arms are not long enough to read the paper anymore?
Yeah.
What do they do?
Absolutely. I mean, we offer broad, I mean, we're not just opticians anymore. We do now do hair care. So we have an audiology, our audiology partners are here once a week. Eventually we envisage that opening up to 2 and 3 days a week as time progresses. We have a full testing equipment. And we have Lynn, who's our partner based out of Swords, myself and our team, Vanda, will come here every Tuesday. We're booked up solid. Again, we offer free tests for audiology.
This is for hearing aids. So as the population grows older, absolutely. This has to be a growth area.
Or people who've worked in heavy industry, who've worked in...
industrial deafness.
Absolutely. You know, so, and then there is obviously the... where people get older, various tones won't be as clear to them as they used to be when they were 40. So it's always wise. It's like anything else. You pay money to get your car serviced every year. Mm-hmm. We panic about the NCT. But we should also be kind of saying, okay, well, I need to get sight tested every 2 years. I got my hearing checked every 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, and again, there's other, so obviously, bar with sight tests, we have got the, which again, the government bought into the budget 2 years ago. We are, most of them are now entitled to a free sight test.
Okay.
You know, every 2 years. And again, a lot of people don't know that and haven't availed of it. Okay. So, and again, so it's worth €30. Plus you also get a contribution towards your glasses, which is €42.37 for single vision glasses. Or if you're wearing varifocals, you're getting €84.19.
So you're getting something that people don't know about.
No,
so
absolutely not.
You can walk into your... you get a lot of stuff in the door with a free eye test to cut off and bring in.
Your PPS number, we're now live to the social welfare. So mm-hmm. we can tap your PPS number, which is date of birth. You obviously bring ID, so we can make sure for data protection purposes everything is covered. But it really is important that people utilise the allowance they have, because I think, especially coming out of the Christmas period, people are going to be tight for cash, you know, mm-hmm. waiting for a second payday to touch down.
Yeah.
There are options there. So our glasses start from €29 up to €239. So okay. there's something there for everybody. We currently carry a range of 1,100 frames.
Okay.
So there's choice there for everybody.
Okay, just getting back to the main business, which is the eye testing.
Yes.
We're going to have a little look around now your operation. Yeah. We're going to see the machines, and maybe you can talk us through what actually happens.
So basically our patients would arrive in store. One of our team would arrive people in. We'd take their details, obviously confirming name, date of birth, etc. Then our patient would perform a pre-test, which is down here in this area here. I see a patient here at the moment. What we perform is we have our OCT machine inside, which is brand new to the business. OCT basically is optical tomography. And what we do there with that is it's a great indicating instrument for people who might have eye conditions, such as glaucoma, etc., etc. It basically is a 3D scan of the eye, very similar to an MRI machine. We are one of 4 stores in the Republic of Ireland in the Specsavers group who have it, and we charge a very nominal fee of €15 as an extra service for that. The uptake has been phenomenal. I think eye care is definitely on the agenda, especially with new technologies, people using iPads, iPhones, high definition televisions. It all affects dry eye, working environments, air conditioning, that kind of stuff. So people are really concerned, and do want to get the best they can. And like I said, we do charge a €15 charge on that, which has been received very, very well from the business. So as you can see, we have a team here at the pre-test area. And what the guys do here is they will take a funded photograph of the back of the eye, which the optometrist would use during the test, again, to pick up on any early stages issues that may be there with the eye. And also we will take the distance and pressures as well on this instrument here. And our OCT machine is there. So we have, it's a very small room, very tight. But if you want to come in this right here, we also have our facimetry here, which we will take measurements of people's glasses as well to see what they were wearing previously for the last 2 years, or if they haven't had an eye test, give us Rory or the optometry team an idea of what exactly prescription they were using beforehand. So I suppose following on from after the test is done and you know the patient's happy to pick their frames and have agreed what lens they want to go for, we have a team of guys who work in store in the lab. We've got Janata and Michael who work 4 days a week in the lab. So we do a lot of our own in-house glazing. The only glazing we don't do is for safety goggles, which go off to a specialist company in the UK for ourselves. But all of our varifocals and single vision lenses are either we have a supply of lenses here in stock or we order them in, and generally our turnaround time for a single vision would be 2 days max time to glaze. So you're looking at basically a window of between 2 and 5 days for single vision. After that, with your varifocals can be up to 10 working days. Again, they've got to be made, and they possibly could be made in Hungary, in one of our labs, or in the UK. As you can hear now, this is our glazing machine in operation. Which again, so the lens itself will be cut generally in 2 minutes or less. Very good. You know.
Taking care of business on Nearby Business.
Now, a new feature on the programme called Taking Care of Business. And Connor Phillips is here to tell us how to prepare for a crisis.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM.
Philosopher Epictetus said, "It's not what happens to you, but how you react that matters." This phrase came to mind as I watched the calamitous events in London unfold recently. I could see there was a sense of fear and hear the beginning of panic creeping into people's voices. One person described the effects of Brexit as Armageddon, the end of the world, literally. One word that's frequently used to describe the situation is crisis. And certainly for some businesses, Brexit is the most significant crisis ever to happen to them. For others, however, it's less significant. It's an issue among many others they need to address. The impact of Brexit will be big or small, depending on your business. But the problem is that you don't know for sure because of the aforementioned calamitous events in London. There's another word I've noticed too, one that unites everyone in anger and frustration. It's uncertainty. The uncertainty around Brexit means planning for it as an issue or a crisis is hard to do. You see, the difficulty in planning for a crisis is that you have to know what you're planning to address, and uncertainty and confusion isn't helpful. Business doesn't like it. It led me to think about how we generally plan for a problem or crisis in our business. Of course, every company is different and issues can be unique. What is common, however, is the risk to your reputation when a crisis hits. And this is an area often neglected by management teams until it's too late. They say you shouldn't wait until you're in a crisis to come up with a crisis communications plan. And I agree. But how do you do that? The obvious answer is to enlist the services of a public relations company who have the expertise in crisis planning. The alternative is to do it yourself. I wondered if I could come up with an easy-to-remember formula or template that would help you to build a crisis communication plan if you decided on the DIY route. After giving it some thought, I came up with just 4 questions you need to ask yourself. 1. What could happen? 2. How likely is that to happen? 3. What's the impact on my business if that happens? And 4. What do I do as a result? The mind boggles when you think of all the things that could happen to your business, and yet creating a list of all the things that could happen to your business is exactly the best place to start. It's perhaps easier to begin by thinking in terms of types or categories of events rather than the specific events themselves. You might list things like natural disasters, product defects, changes in company policy, or technology issues like cyber attacks or a software glitch, or even employee-related issues like redundancies and strikes. When you've come up with a reasonable list of all the things that could happen, you next need to ask yourself, how likely is that to happen? You might decide to rank the issues on a scale of 1 to 5, ranging from very unlikely to certain to happen. Next, you need to assess the impact on your business. Again, a scale of 1 to 5, ranging from insignificant to extreme, might be useful. Finally, you can begin to write your communication plan for each event that's likely to happen and also have an impact on your business. If, by the way, the impact is short term, it's an issue. If there could be long term damage to your business, it's a crisis. And an issue can grow into a crisis if handled badly. By anticipating issues and planning for them, you'll be better prepared to protect your reputation and react in a calm and controlled way when the crisis strikes. Your crisis communication team will be identified and will be familiar with their role in the plan, while your spokespeople will be practiced and ready for action. You'll have a system in place to monitor publicity, while your team members deliver accurate messages to your employees and customers. Creating holding statements for each crisis in advance can really help you buy time. You might say, for example, we have implemented our crisis response plan to ensure the safety of all our staff. You can't plan for everything, of course, particularly when it's unexpected. I'm reminded of the shop that had its roof torn off with the JCB in the pursuit of bread during the Beast from the East snow last year. Some things just can't be foreseen. We hope the fog of Brexit clears soon, so you know what you have to plan for. But keep in mind the wise words of the Greek philosopher. It's not what happens to you, but how you react that matters. That's Taking Care of Business for this week with me, Conor Phillips. Thanks for listening.
And thanks a million to Conor for that. And Conor will be coming a regular feature on Nearby Business over the coming weeks. Yeah, hard to believe. Myself and Dave were just chatting earlier, but Nearby Business is all of 1 year and almost 1 month old at this stage, Dave, which is hard to imagine. We've been through a year. This is our third run, if you like.
Yeah, Series 3. We started on the 11th of
January
last year, and ran to the summer and then in the autumn as well. So great to be back again. And we've got freshened ideas all back after our break and ready to go again. And if anybody's out there and has a business that wants to feature or wants to come in and tell us about your story, you're the local listeners, you're the local businesses. That's why we are Near FM. Near FM is Northeast Access Radio. Absolutely. And Nearby Business.
We'd and Nearby Business. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to chat to you. We could pop out and see you maybe someday, or you're welcome to come in here.
Even if you're a one-man band or you've got 150 people, just tell us what you do and we'd love to help you.
We'd love to talk to you. Speaking of being just back from the break, Dave, you were in Australia for some of the break and you got some sort of insights into what's happening out there in the economy.
Yeah, I was in Australia. Luckily enough, I was down to visit my son who's there for a year, and I was in Sydney and Melbourne. The country has 25 million population, and from a reasonably new and young country, relatively there a couple of hundred years as a developed country, so to speak, they're the 12th biggest economy in the world. They've about 5% unemployment, which is a full unemployment.
Similar to ourselves here now.
Fairly similar to what we have here.
Yeah.
There's reports in the paper the weekend that there's a possibility of a kind of a recession coming on there. Property prices are quite high. Wage levels are kind of reached what they can do. I just had the experience of meeting two sets of people from Ireland who've moved out there in the last 6 months.
Right.
And interesting to hear their stories. And
how are they getting on?
They're doing good. Look, you know, one particular couple, the person qualified here with a degree and is working in a field that she could be working here in, and she's making a living, but that's it. There isn't, you know, it's not paid for
no
gold.
Yeah.
And her partner is working in construction, so they're enjoying the sunshine and living away. But it's not like gonna be forever. And then the other guy who I know as well, we met him. He's having a great time. He's actually working in a dynamic business of prestige car sales. And he's earning very good money on a sort of a sales and commission basis, right, as well. But he's working in a showroom, so there's lots of business. So they sell Maseratis and all these top end
cars.
And
I suppose with the economy booming, plenty of deals to be done there.
Yeah, he's absolutely happy out down there, and he's doing very, very well down there. So there's a tale of two sides. Lots of Irish people living down there. You see jerseys from the county football teams going around. You hear accents at traffic lights. I was standing in Sydney last week, and there's two girls behind me with the Irish country accents. They were talking about Derry girls, and they said, I love Derry girls. And I resisted the temptation to turn around and say hello, because it would have been a little bit creepy.
What about
a guy
you?
In shorts, yeah. And runners saying, hello, I'm from Ireland. But the city itself in Sydney is a little bit like San Francisco, I believe. It's kind of hilly and American style, whereas Melbourne is more like a European city. Yeah, kind of with a river, like a German city with a river running through it. They have a great attitude. TV is great over there. It's Americanized. It's like Anchorman, and they have great channels. They have a Sky channel, very similar to the Sky channel. And they shorten and abbreviate everything with an IE at the end of it. So Tasmania is Tassie. And all that sort of thing. It's really
brilliant.
Good.
Okay. Well, thanks a million, Dave, for that update on your trip to Australia.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Okay.
Too easy.
Yeah, champion. You missed your cue.
Sorry about that.
Okay, coming up in the second part of the show, we've got our regular look at HR issues with David Bell from the HR department. This week we're looking at how to conduct an exit interview, and we'll also be chatting with Alan McQuaid, who is the chief economist with Merriam Private. He'll be here to chat a little bit more about that hot topic of the week. Yes, it is indeed Brexit. All of that to come on Nearby Business.
This is 90.3.
This is Near FM.
Your HR questions answered on Nearby Business.
David Bell from the HR department is here now for his regular look at HR issues. This week, David, we're going to talk about how to manage employees, I suppose, out of the company, or how to manage an exit interview. So gone are the days, I suppose, when people decided they were in a company or in a job for life.
Yeah, absolutely, Declan. I think, that's even truer as the years go by. We've touched on it on a couple of occasions about millennials and some of the challenges in the workplace. But definitely, I think the career path of most people today would result in four or five potentially different jobs and different roles. And that's just the way things have gone. It's not the same as maybe going in and having the very defined career path. A lot of it is a springboard to something else if they're not capable of getting something in their current workplace. So yeah, it would be, I suppose, more unusual. It's not unheard of, but I think it would be more unusual to have people, working 25, 30 years in the same company and working their way through it. A lot of people now, I think, are prepared much quicker to move on.
Yeah. And in terms of the exit interview, how long is it around? Is it a relatively new phenomenon to have this exit interview or to have this chat with an employee when they leave? I mean, in the past, did people just go and they sort of went and people didn't take much notice of it one way or the other, really?
Yeah. I mean, again, I suppose it has been around. It's probably becoming more in the mainstream. Like a lot of companies, the more progressive ones would probably consider, why people are leaving to be a much more important question than others. And sometimes, not to disparage anyone, but sometimes someone leaving, it's a natural, as I said, they've got a job that's more attractive, or it could be a geographical change, or it could just be that they have reached the top of where they can go and there isn't any further. So that everyone understands that that's potentially going to happen. I think where the problems are, particularly at the moment, even with all of the uncertainty with Brexit and all those things that are happening, the job market is still very competitive at the moment, and certain industries, people are definitely, it's the employees' market, for want of a better expression. So, now when people leave, companies are more concerned, I suppose, as to why they're leaving, both in terms of looking back at themselves to see could they have done things differently, could they have done things better, is it money, is it something else, but also, when in the retention of people and try, if you've invested I'm sure, like in your own businesses, where you've worked, you know, you've people have been trained, they've had money invested in them, sometimes significantly. And there's also that element to it that you have to start again, so to speak, unless there's someone who's a natural fit into that role. So it can have both financial, it can also, it can sometimes disrupt a team if it's someone that's seen as a very key person in a team and they go, other people might get a bit jittery. And then across the company, I mean, one of the things we all know, I'm sure you're on LinkedIn like I am. I mean, you know, I get 20 notifications a week or whatever it is saying, congratulate John for moving position. So yeah. It's very public often.
Yeah.
And if someone is moving a lot, or if a number of people are leaving the same company, the world at large gets to hear about it, which is, I suppose, something that's relatively new. And that can cause problems.
Yeah. And in terms, David, of when you should do the exit interview, I mean, clearly the exit interview is at the point where the employee is actually leaving and going. It's not an interview to try and persuade the employee to stay.
No, it's not. I mean, that might have been a place. And again, I suppose some of the expressions that we would use around this is what we say is we got good leavers and bad leavers. So
Okay. Generally
a bad leaver, you've probably heard the expression, is where there's been some acrimony. So either an unresolved issue or maybe performance that has resulted in maybe a mutual parting of the ways, that there may have been some financial exchange or maybe not. Maybe the employee has and maintains a certain adversarial position against the company, either will continue on and take a case against them, or even if they don't, aren't leaving with a very pleasant disposition towards the company. And that obviously has its own problems, because they go into the outside world and they might criticize individuals, or they might criticize the company, and that has its own problems. So yes, I mean, if there are problems or people raise it at performance reviews about salaries or position or ambition, you know, that is the time, I suppose, to start trying to address it. But I think once, you know, there is obviously still people who use job offers as a way of perhaps increasing their value in a company that they're already in, the bane of the recruiter's life, and they always have to be very mindful of that.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, generally speaking, if someone has handed in their notice, we would, you know, and it's clear they're going, and anything that has been done to try and make them stay, if that's what the company wants, has happened, it is an opportunity to try and, like, sit down with them. Because they're going, maybe they might be a bit more open about certain things. So, you know, we would have some forms that some of our clients use just to go through, and that's pretty obvious, the questions, you know, why are you leaving, what could we have done better, in a nutshell, you know, was it your manager, was there something your manager could have done differently, you know, and you're, you know, each one of those would have a series of questions around it, and you're really just trying to elicit information. It is a fact-finding exercise to try and improve things, would it be
good practice for not the line manager to do that, if that's possible, maybe a HR department or another person in the company, perhaps in a smaller company, not necessarily the owner, you know, maybe somebody like yourself that would conduct that on their behalf?
Absolutely, and especially, as you say, and you know, where there's some sensitive questions being asked, and perhaps they're reluctant to say it to someone in the company, and you obviously have to have some certain amount of confidentiality, and you're not looking to, you know, point the finger, point blame. But it is generally a fact-finding, information-gathering exercise. And it's not like you're necessarily going to punish someone because of it, or they're in difficulty. It's really just to find out. Because obviously, if you, you know, it's obvious to say, but if you have two or three of these and the same stuff keeps coming up, be it your salaries are too low, so you're not benchmarked against market best practice or the market value, or there's a particular manager who's losing staff because of the way that maybe they approach it, the way they manage or don't manage, as the case may be. So if you have then teams that start to come out, is it your location? You know, there's all sorts of different reasons why people go. And what you're looking for, I suppose, if you're consistent with the questioning and you're consistent and people do are happy to answer them, you probably, you know, the idea is that you start to see some sort of trend, hopefully, that you can address and change, rather than just scratching your head saying, why is everyone leaving, or why is that particular group? I can't seem to hang on to anyone in that area.
Yeah.
Is it a competitor that has their eye on your staff? I mean, you know, you hear these stories where they, you know, someone I know, there's one particular client of mine who realized he was really good at training people. He could never hang on to them.
Right.
And it was a very specific technical business. But he just recognized that he was, once they got to a certain stage, they were snapped up by everyone else.
Right.
Because he was so good at training them. But he was obviously getting frustrated.
Yeah.
And I don't mean training. I'm talking about a 4 or 5 year plan, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that maybe is in the extreme, but it's that type of thing. You're saying, why are these people? And some of them are going to the same company. So you can ask that question if they're prepared to tell you, where are you going? You know, and again, it's really just for information. Is this the same company that's coming in, swooping in, taking my staff? So I think it is, you know, and it's not always, it's probably the last thing in people's minds, you know, they want it, you know, they're working their notice out or not, as the case may be. There might be a going away, a bit of a get together. That's probably less nowadays. You know, I think in maybe in our day, it was a bit more formal and people were maybe around a lot longer, more of a retirement. It was much more of
more,
an event.
More of an event.
Nowadays,
yeah.
If you had a going away for everyone who left,
you'd be, you could be a party every week. And yeah. And tell me, David, is this something that you would cover off in a contract of employment when somebody was coming in? I mean, would you put in that there is a requirement or an obligation or whatever to have an exit interview? Would you cover it that way? Or is it something that's sort of optional for people?
I think it's probably optional. If you want to get value, if people feel they have to do it, I think it's, you know, it might set some sort of boundaries around what they are, and if they feel it's an obligation. You know, if people are just not interested in doing it and refuse to do it, it's probably not worth it anyway, you know.
Yeah, you won't get quality answers, I suppose.
You don't get quality. Yeah. You're going to get guarded answers. They're not going to tell you anything. But certainly, you know, I going back to the point you asked, you know, we've done these and you know, you can see, because people, as I said, because they're leaving, they're not trying to damage or you know, criticize people or the company as a sort of a parting gift. It's more if it's seen as a genuine attempt to try and make things better for others or to improve certain areas, and it's seen in that light, people are more forthcoming. I mean, there's always that reluctance, as you mentioned there, but if it was your line manager or they were involved, you know, people don't necessarily, no matter how difficult it might have been, they don't necessarily want to criticize individuals because they don't want it to sort of come back on them. But having said that, you can often find out things. You don't have to note it on the form. You know, you can find out certain things yourself, and it doesn't have to go in writing. And again, there's no consequences for it.
Yeah.
But it could be something that can help identify issues that are sort of coming up all the time that need to be addressed.
Yeah, and I guess it's to approach it in that way, with a positive attitude, to learn from it, and I suppose then to take on board what you've found and implement change insofar as you can to make sure that you hold on to the talent in the business that you have.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, David. Well, look, that's, as usual, a fantastic comprehensive look at exit interviews and how you might go about them and the worth of them and the quality of them and how to tackle them and so on. So thanks a million. That's David Bell there from the HR department for the regular look at HR issues this week, as I said, looking at how to conduct a really good exit interview and get the best out of it. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Declan.
This is Nearby Business.
And don't forget, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can contact the show by text while we're on the air. The text line is open. It's 087 69 44 500, 087 69 44 500. Or you can get in touch anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz. Alan McQuaid, Chief Economist with Merriam Private, is here now to talk to me about the one big issue that's occupying the minds of most business people, be they involved in big business or small. That is, of course, Brexit. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Declan. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Alan, I suppose it is on the minds of all business people, local business people here on the north side of Dublin as well. And there are lots of implications depending on what might happen. I suppose maybe first we might look at what would happen in the event of no deal, in your opinion? What are the implications for business and what might they need to think about?
Well, I think the obvious one would be on the currency front. I mean, if there's a no deal, I think sterling's going to weaken dramatically and every chance to hit parity against the euro. So, I mean, if you're, so from that point of view, if you're exporting and depending on sending goods to the UK, it's going to become more expensive because obviously demand from the UK is going to falter. Of course, on the other hand, if your business is sort of encouraging people to go abroad or go to the UK, or if you're a travel agent or whatever, and you're organising trips to London or the rest of England or the rest of the UK, that'll be a positive development. But I think clearly the unknown is the tariff element, which in a no deal Brexit, I think you can imagine there will be. I mean, it's hard to see not there being a border looks like a quite sort of an obvious sort of result of the whole thing. Now I know there's talk that they don't want a hard border, but if there is a no deal, I mean, it's very difficult to see how they can avoid that. So that's going to be have huge implications. I mean, look at the overall, I suppose, scenario that most analysts are speculating on is that Brexit, the two big areas that are going to be losers will be the agri-food sector. So if you're in that sector, you're going to suffer because, you know, substantial amount of those exports go to the UK. And retail distribution will also suffer because there's going to be backlogs in terms of lorries getting through, and the cost of goods, you know, coming back and forth from Britain will be hit. So, I mean, like, people forget, like, while we export a lot to the UK, we import an awful lot from the UK as well. And so there will be good news and bad news there, because, as I said, if the currency weakens, sterling weakens, it makes it cheaper to import those goods. But, I mean, at the same time, there's likely to be tariffs to offset that, which, you know, will hit both consumers and businesses here.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned the tariffs there, and clearly, is it correct to say that we would revert to the world trade tariffs, which are quite substantial and quite complex and complicated as well in terms of actually practically implementing them?
Yeah, I think most tariffs are sort of complicated. So I mean, if the World Trade Organization rules would come into force, so that would, you know, that would certainly have a negative impact on the cost of doing trade, which would effectively our closest trading partner. Now, it's not our biggest partner in terms of exports anymore, but it's certainly a substantial player in the whole thing in terms of employment, in terms of, you know, the goods moving back and forth, whether it be exports or imports. So if you go to the WTO rules, you know, it's going to have a detrimental effect on people, who SME sectors, who are looking at exporting their goods or importing goods from across the water.
Yeah, indeed. And you also mentioned there the retail distribution. And while there's a lot of focus on the north-south and, you know, the hard border, you know, a couple of miles up the road effectively, but the sort of east-west axis is sort of vitally important for that particular industry as well. I mean, getting the goods into Dublin Port is more important probably for you know, the food we eat than taking it down the road from Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and you're right. And like, I think, I mean, we just don't know, but I think if you're putting money on it, you just envisage that there are going to be greater delays, there's going to be bigger sort of, you know, tailbacks in terms of lorries getting, you know, or getting onto boats or whatever, or just moving up the north, or, you know, trying to get up that part of the country. So it's going to add time, and time, you know, costs money, etc. So it's lost money and lost revenue. So It's the last thing, you know, we want. I mean, I think in every other scenario, bar a hard one, I think sterling will actually strengthen. So again, there'll be good news and bad news there. But in terms of Ireland Inc., it's generally accepted that, given that we're an exporting country and highly dependent on exports, that obviously a stronger sterling is beneficial to us in the overall scheme of things, even though stronger sterling makes it more expensive to go abroad if you're going to the UK on business or whatever, you know.
The current deal that's on the table, which I suppose seems unlikely to get through the UK Parliament at this stage, with all of the various votes and so on that we've had in the last couple of weeks. I mean, if the current deal is in some miracle way ratified by the British Parliament, everything stays the same for at least a period of time anyway, isn't that the case?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the least bad option for us. And I think the overall negative impact would be fairly small. I mean, I think the the ESRI, I think the most recent group to come out with forecasts, effectively said they saw the economy growing by 4 to 5% this year. So, and even the hard Brexit, we still grow by 2%. So we're still going to grow. But I mean, if we've got a sort of the deal that's on the table or an improved deal or whatever, I mean, there's no reason why the economy can't continue to prosper at the level that's been growing in recent years. Now, clearly, if they leave with the deal that's on the table and there's a soft option, it's not going to be immediate in terms of the impact. I mean, clearly there's a transition period, so it's going to be some while before you see it. And I think unless there is sort of they just crash out, I mean, the real impact on Ireland probably won't be felt for 12 to 18 months in terms of where we're going, where we're headed, and what happens on the trade front. So in that sense, there's still a lot of unknowns out there, and unknowns don't help, because if you're trying to plan your business and you're trying to look at investment and what you should be doing, you want certainty rather than sort of this might happen, that might happen, and we might have A, B, C, D, or Z as an outcome. That doesn't help. So, unfortunately, we're 2.5 years into this process. We're none the wiser how it's going to play out. All we can say is, fingers crossed, it works out in our favour. But, there is going to be some negative impacts no matter what happens. And all you can hope for is that the damage is very limited rather than sort of extreme, which would happen in terms of a no deal Brexit or a hard departure. Now, I still think going forward in the long run, we will get through it, and we're a fairly resilient bunch here on this island. I mean, we were written off at the height of the financial crisis, and people are saying we would never bounce back from it, and yet here we are.
We're going all right at the moment anyway.
Our economy is still fastest growing in Europe. It has been for the last 5 years.
Yeah, indeed.
And unemployment has gone from 16% down to just over 5%. So we are doing something right. So I think we have that sort of resilience in us, where our history shows that we're not easily beaten. And so even if things go pear-shaped in terms of the Brexit deal, I've no doubt that we will come fighting through at the end of it all. Although it may take a couple of years to get through the shock if it is a hard sort of departure by the UK.
Yeah. Would you speculate what a different deal might look like, or what a compromise deal might look like in somewhere between the current and the no deal?
Well, I think the deal the two deals that we mentioned that people cited, a Norwegian deal or a Canadian deal. Now, Norway, the problem with the Norwegian deal for the hardline Brexiteers is that it keeps them very much in the trade area, in the European trade area, which is a positive. But from their point of view, that deal, the deal that the Norwegians have with the EU, there's free movement of people, and that's obviously something that the Brexiteers, the hardliners, are opposed to. I mean, that's clearly one of the key reasons they opted to leave the EU, is the fact that they could control who was coming in and out of their country. So that one, in that sense, it's hard to see where they go for that one. In terms of Canada, it's taken them 7 years to negotiate a deal with the EU. So from that point of view, it might take a long time for Britain to get deals, in terms of what it wants to do. But the advantage is that it wouldn't be tied into the EU in terms of having to live by the EU rules. The services industry would suffer. I mean, services doesn't come out well in that deal. But I think if I were them, I'd probably be opting for the Canadian deal rather than the Norwegian one, because the Norwegian one, Norwegian one would be better for us here in Ireland, I think. From the Brexiteer's point of view, in terms of moving the people, that would be a step too far. Sure. But look, I think any deal, get them bar the one that they sort of bar the hardline one, is probably we'll probably cope with it.
Yeah.
There will be knock-on effects, but I don't think that we can't overcome them.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. And I know there's a lot of probably political manoeuvring and so on and so forth to happen in the coming weeks and perhaps even months as well. It was interesting you talk about the Norwegian deal there. I saw a quote recently in a piece by fellow economist David McWilliams, where he said John Hume once described the Good Friday Agreement as the Sunningdale Agreement for slow learners, and he was advocating that perhaps the Norwegian deal would be the Brexit for slow learners. So I thought it was an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, I think part of the problem with all this is that I think they were shocked themselves, the pro-Brexit camp, and they really didn't have any plan in place, and that's been quite obvious really in the 2.5 years that have passed by since, that really, you know, we're still at a stage now that we don't know exactly what they want. I don't think they know themselves what they want. And that doesn't help, you know, trying to negotiate a deal, whether it be with the EU or anybody else.
Yeah.
If you don't know exactly, if you're not clear in your own mind what you want, then it's very, very hard for the other side to actually agree with you or compromise with you. And I think that's part of the problem. I think they were shocked themselves that they won the vote and then they were left with, so what do we do next? I think they're only now trying to explore the avenues of where they could go, and so I suppose all options are on the table to some degree. But I think the only thing that you'd like to see is that there's some deal and that they don't just crash out of it. I think you want to see something that's in place and something that tries to minimise the damage for us. You know, certainly in terms of having no border between north and south, and in terms of limiting the damage from tariffs, etc. So I think it's anybody's guess what's going to happen, but hopefully it will come to a positive conclusion. If I had to put my money on it, I think there will be an extension of the deadline, so that it'll go beyond the end of March deadline. But of course, the things are complicated by the fact that there are European parliamentary elections at the end of May, and if you're still in the EU at that stage, you know, you may well be forced to put forward candidates, which may not be what they want to do across the border. So there's a lot of issues there, both politically and economically, that with question marks over them. So I think the economists are none the wiser in terms of what's going to happen from compared to yourself or anybody else in terms of out there on the street. I mean, it's still very much up in the air.
Yeah, indeed. And, hopefully, as you say, somewhere between the current deadline of the end of March and perhaps an extended deadline that may inevitably have to run out before those European elections, hopefully business will get some certainty, Alan, and we'll be in a position to drive on and keep the economy growing at the rates of the 4 to 5 rather than and the 2%, which would be definitely better for everybody. Thanks a million, Alan, for joining me this evening and taking the time to explore those different options on that topic that's on small business and indeed big business minds at the moment, that of Brexit. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Declan.
AOB on Nearby Business.
A little bit of news on jobs. The owner of Supermax fast food chain is to create 300 jobs with the opening of new outlets and the redevelopment of 3 hotels his company has taken over. Pat McDonough and his wife Una announced the plans yesterday in County Leash, where a regional enterprise plan for the Midlands was also launched in a separate development. The Supermax founder announced the creation of 200 jobs with the opening of new fast food outlets in Wexford, Waterford, Kinnegad in County Westmeath, and another 100 jobs were created through the redevelopment of hotels, the Athlone Springs, the Collection in Port Leash, and the Castle Oaks in Limerick, which he bought just before Christmas. Supermax also gone for planning for new plaza developments in Letterkenny, Longford, Ennis and Port Leash, with the promise of 300 more jobs down the line. So chips and burgers on the menu
all
there
around
for the Midlands and all
some of the Midlands indeed. While you were away, you mightn't have seen the judgment, but he did win his case for the moment anyway against McDonald's for the Mac sort of
name,
trademark and all of that. So very, very interesting, and a good Irish entrepreneur and we wish him success.
Yeah, absolutely.
In his different ventures. Well, believe it or not, we're almost at the end of our first Nearby Business back live on Thursday evening. Thanks very much to all our contributors this evening. We'll both be back at the same time next week with another Nearby Business. In the meantime, don't forget, if you have a comment on any of the stories featured today or an idea you'd like to discuss with us, well, you can get in touch on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
Okay, and for me, Declan Rath, we'll see you soon on the radio. Bye for now. Bye-bye.